Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Lesotho Prime Minister Thabane is charged with the murder of his estranged wife.
SABC, a party that Ndati Thabane is leading, believes in a rule of law. Even himself, he has been saying that nobody is above the law. All of us are equal before the law.
Nigerian authorities are searching for over 250 inmates freed during a prison attack. Sudanese pro-democracy groups took to the streets again on Tuesday, criticizing their prime minister for signing a deal with the military. Today, December 1st, is World AIDS Day. And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta criticizes Omicron travel bans.
COVID will not be defeated by locking us all down, by shutting off parts of the world you think are problematic. No one will be safe from COVID until we're all safe.
And despite risks, the number of African migrants crossing the Mediterranean has doubled. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane was charged on Tuesday with the murder of his estranged wife, Lepolelo Thabane, who was shot to death in her car in June 2017, just a few days before Thabane was to be sworn in for the second time as Prime Minister. Thabane subsequently married the much younger Masaya Thabane, who was also charged last year with Lepolelo's murder. The 82-year-old Thomas Thabane and his wife Masaya, 42, have both denied involvement in the killing of Lepolelo. Lebo Hanklale is the Secretary General of the ruling All Basotho Convention ABC Party. He says the party and former Prime Minister Thabane believe in the rule of law.
Yes, it is true that Ndate Thabane was in South Africa. He was consulting his doctor. He came back last week, Sunday. He's in the country. Yes, he appeared for a pre-trial because the investigations for allegations of murder, attempted murder, and damage to property are finalized or completed.
What has happened to the case of former First Lady Masaya Thabane? We understand she was charged some time back. What has happened to her case?
He was with his wife, Ms. Masaya Thabane. He was also informed, both of them were informed about the charges and also the dates of trial, which are 8, 9 and 10 March 2022.
As you know, Lesotho is constantly in political instability. Don't you think that charging the former Prime Minister Thabane could be an additional fuel to Lesotho's political problems?
On a question of whether this is a political matter, I cannot comment on that one. But as ABC, a party that Ndati Thabane is leading, believes in a rule of law, and even himself, he has been saying on numerous occasions that nobody is above the law. All of us are equal before the law, and he leads by example. Hence, when he was requested to appear today for pre-trial, he did not hesitate.
Thank you so much, sir. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Lebohan Kwakle is Secretary General of the ruling All Basotho Convention ABC Party of Lesotho. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta delivered his eighth and perhaps last State of the Nation address on Tuesday, outlining what he believed to be key achievements of his 8 years in power. As Atieno Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the address comes 8 months before the end of Mr. Kenyatta's tenure in office.
Speaking to a joint sitting of the Senate and National Assembly, President Kenyatta appealed to Western nations to stop issuing travel bans to African countries. He said the coronavirus cannot be defeated by shutting off certain countries and that Kenya will not issue any travel bans. The president also urged Kenyans to come out in large numbers and get vaccinated amid the Omicron variant, which experts say is the most dangerous variant yet.
COVID will not be defeated by locking us all down, by shutting off parts of the world you think are problematic. No one will be safe from COVID until we're all safe. Shot in the arm is the most powerful weapon against the disease that has ravaged the world. That shot in the arm of every adult Kenyan will also be a shot in the arm for our economy and our social institutions. It ensures that we can conquer, that if we can conquer and put this disease aside and fully return to normal, we can continue on our growth trajectory.
President Kenyatta brought about political stability when he shook hands with opposition leader Raila Odinga, something he said later led to the birth of the Constitutional Amendment Bill, popularly known as the Building Bridges Initiative or BBI. However, President Kenyatta said the judiciary ruling against the Constitution review process was a huge loss for Kenyans.
Kenya missed the possibility to increase the minimum county allocation from the current 15% to 35%. And the logic here was to ensure that if we percolate the proposed 35% of our national revenues to counties, women should be at the center of decision making on how this revenue is utilized. But honorable members, this did not happen. The third loss was about expanding our national executive to accommodate a broader face of Kenya and to expand representation. This would have constitutionalized the end of the winner-takes-all outcomes of elections that creates so much toxicity and tension.
President Kenyatta said devolution or the delegation of power to municipalities, which was first implemented in his regime, has led to counties working more effectively. For example, the president announced that Nakuru County will now be granted city charter today, Wednesday, making it the fourth city in Kenya after Nairobi, Kisumu, and Mombasa.
As the first president to implement the 2010 constitution, the task of rolling out devolution fell squarely on me. Once sleepy towns across the country have now roared back into life, driving not just grand infrastructure projects, but also tangible increases in household incomes of ordinary Kenya. As devolution takes root, I will tomorrow, the 1st of December 2021, have the high privilege of conferring on Nakuru Municipality city status. Nakuru City will join Kisumu, Mombasa, and Nairobi as cities.
The constitution requires the president once every year to report in an address to the nation all the measures taken and the progress achieved in the realization of the national values. Tuesday's speech was President Kenyatta's eighth State of the Nation address since his assumption of office as the fourth president of the nation. It would likely be his last because his second and final term ends in August 2022. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Sudanese pro-democracy groups took to the streets again on Tuesday, criticizing Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok for signing a deal with the military. The November 21st agreement led to Hamdok's reinstatement and empowered him to form a cabinet without the approval of his former political coalition comprising the Forces for Freedom and Change. Some say the agreement legitimizes the October 25th military takeover. Journalist Michael Ati joins us now from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
This is a series of the ongoing protests that has been taking place after the 25th of October. Yesterday's protest was mainly to protest against the recent political agreement that was signed between Prime Minister Hamdok and the head of the military, General Al-Burhan. These political activists and protesters are actually categorically rejecting this agreement, and they say this agreement does not represent them, and it does not even help a smooth transition in Sudan that may lead to a genuine and credible election in 2023. They wanted Hamdok to resign because he has betrayed the political forces that brought him initially to this position. So they are saying he no longer represents the revolution. They don't want any partnership any longer between the civilians and the military. They should never involve in the politics again. The military should go back to their barracks. And they are also demanding justice for their dear ones and loved ones who have been killed, especially after the 25th of October. According to the reports, there are nearly 43 that have been killed and hundreds of others who were wounded.
Michael, Prime Minister Hamdok said he signed the agreement with General Burhan to stop the killing to bring peace to Sudan. To what degree is what is happening now a popular view in Sudan?
If you look at the protesters themselves, okay, majority of them might be those who are taking part practically in the protest, might be young people. But they are not only in Khartoum. They are all over. They are in the other states' capital as well. And they are raising the same concern. They are telling the government or Prime Minister Hamdok and military leader Al-Burhan the same concern. Things are not going right. Al-Burhan and Hamdok might continue with their agenda, with their plan of forming the transitional cabinet maybe in a week to come, and appointing state governors and all, try to move the agreement forward. But then this agreement is now faced with this rejection from majority of the Sudanese, even though they are representing political forces that might have been sidelined by Al-Burhan's decision, but yet we still consider them as Sudanese who are rejecting this agreement.
General Burhan had promised to release some political detainees. Has that happened?
Yesterday, they released the last two or three former ministers who have been detained since 25th of October. And it is noticeable that they were released just an hour or so before the protest could kick off in Khartoum. So immediately, the former minister of trade and the spokesperson of the legal group that was formed to collect the assets and fines of the previous government, they were released, and immediately they went on the street, and they were even in the front line with the protesters demanding the same thing.
Michael, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you always.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
That was journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 1st. The United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, also known as UNAIDS, says there could be at least 7.7 million AIDS-related deaths in the next 10 years if world leaders don't address inequalities. The agency says new HIV infections have increased drastically, with 1.5 million new infections globally in 2020. As Maureen Odhiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, 29% of all new HIV infections in Kenya are among adolescents and youths, as the country struggles with antiretroviral drugs and condom shortages.
As the world commemorates the World AIDS Day today, inequality is still a factor while addressing the pandemic. According to the World Health Organization, 37.7 million people are living with HIV across the world. In Africa, there are roughly 23.8 million infected persons, as 91% of the world's HIV-positive children live in the continent. Dr. Ruth Masha, the Chief Executive Officer for National AIDS Control Council Kenya, said that 60% of new infections in Kenya occur in young people.
In Kenya, more than 60% of the new infections among adults occurring from this group of young people. This is quite a serious matter, and because these are the future mothers and also fathers, as well as the people who are expected to drive the economy in the future.
Eunice Nduta, 41-year-old Kenyan, was diagnosed with HIV in 2004. After her fiancé, who never became a husband, insisted they get tested before marriage. She turned to prayers and traditional herbs, hoping for a healing, but all was in vain.
I knew my status when I had a boyfriend who wanted to marry me, but he insisted that we could go for HIV test. That's when I knew my status. I wasn't sick. There was no sign. And the doctor told us that one of you is sick. So I was thinking I was not the one, but unfortunately, I was the one. I didn't start the drugs immediately. I started going to church that the pastor could pray for me and get healed.
She, however, does not disclose the status to many people, since her past experience made her undergo stigma.
I do not tell people about my HIV status because there is one time I tried to tell my colleagues in a certain farm in Naivasha and they gave out the story to everyone. I didn't have friends.
According to the law, one should not disclose the HIV/AIDS status of someone else to the third party without their consent. Helen Namiesi, chairperson HIV and AIDS Tribunal in Kenya, says that no one should be forced to take HIV tests.
No person should be forced to take an HIV test in order to enjoy employment, travel in and out of the country, marriage, admission to any educational institution, or provision of health care, insurance cover, or any other service.
With Kenya currently experiencing antiretroviral drugs and HIV testing kit shortage, the government is yet to handle the situation. The Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union has expressed its concerns on increasing number of HIV among the newborns, as many pregnant mothers are missing out on the HIV testing due to lack of testing kits. The Joint United Nations Programme on HIV and AIDS, UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima, said that the world is not acting fast enough to end the HIV pandemic.
We are not yet acting fast enough to stop the AIDS pandemic. Our new analysis shows that if we continue as we are, if we do not take the steps necessary to speed access and close inequalities in the HIV response, the world could face 7.7 million AIDS deaths over the next 10 years.
Byanyima says inequalities within countries is preventing universal progress on the fight against HIV.
Inequalities between and within countries are preventing universal progress. The pace of HIV testing declined almost uniformly around the world.
6 months ago, the United Nations member states agreed to a new approach to address inequalities to close gaps in HIV service access by 2025 and to get on track to the global goal of ending AIDS by 2030. In 2020, WHO says more than 680,000 people died of HIV. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Nigerian authorities are searching for more than 250 inmates still at large after an armed group attacked a prison in the central city of Jos. Prison authorities said 9 escapees were killed in clashes with security forces. It is the fourth attack this year by armed groups on prisons in Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
An unspecified number of heavily armed men invaded the medium security prison yard in the city of Jos on Sunday evening, shooting sporadically. Nigerian prison services officials say one soldier was killed during exchange of gunfire with the armed men and one prison staffer was shot in the hand. Officials say one attacker was killed and more than 250 inmates were freed. They say 6 inmates were injured during the attack and are receiving treatment. This was the fourth major attack on prisons this year in the West African nation. Nigeria Prison Services Public Relations Officer Francis Inobore describes the incident as unfortunate.
Unfortunately, we are now faced with this new sheriff in town. Coming to invade the facility with military grade weapons, including explosives and all of that. But we are not folding our arms.
Last month, a similar attack on a prison in southwestern Oyo State freed about 392 inmates. In April, Correctional Service authorities in southeastern Imo State said 1,844 inmates escaped after a prison attack that was blamed on a separatist group, the Indigenous People of Biafra or IPOB. The group denied the accusation. Inobore says authorities are taking steps to prevent further jailbreaks.
We are trying to upgrade the training of our armed corps personnel. The military is assisting us in that regard so that we will be able to deploy the military-grade weapons to be able to withstand those attackers. We are also working on reclaiming our buffer zones. What buffer zone does is to enable you to profile whoever is encroaching into your territory.
Last week, Nigerian authorities designated certain armed groups in the country as terrorist organizations. Experts praised the move, saying that charging the groups with terror-related offenses will make it easier to crack down on their activities. But security expert and former defense spokesperson John Ajim says there is more to be done.
The prison officials should be able to study the pattern of the breaks and know where the problem is from. Maybe what they're supposed to do is to look at the caliber of prisoners they have. Then they will know what level of security they will require to safeguard the prison, those prisoners.
There were some 1,060 inmates at the Jos prison before Sunday's attack. Prison authorities and the police are searching for 252 escapees who have been missing since the break. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In search of a better life, many migrants try to cross what has been dubbed the deadliest border in the world, the Mediterranean Sea. Despite the risks, the International Organization for Migration says the number of people crossing has doubled in the first half of this year to an estimated 77,000. For VOA, Ruth Elmendor reports from on board the Ocean Viking, a rescue vessel in the Mediterranean.
We're on the Mediterranean Sea in international waters in front of the Libyan coast. We're in an inflatable rescue ship dispatched by the group SOS Mediterranee. And before us is a small wooden boat dancing on the waves. And we hear the calling of more than 100 migrants on board. And one can only imagine what's it like to be floating here without an engine and only the stars as a witness of your presence. The rescuers give life jackets in case the overloaded boat breaks. Then the migrants start to cross, one by one, into the rescue boat. Nobody is left behind. For them, this small step is a giant leap to a better life. Conditions at sea can be devastating, says a rescuer, who identified himself only as Tangi.
We had operation with people suffering from bullet wounds. Sometimes you have some people who already died in the target because of suffocation, because of whatever. So it's like it's very different all the time.
Requiring green light to disembark 19 mile.
Propelled by the heavy dual engines, the rescue boat returns to the mothership, Ocean Viking, which is chartered by SOS Mediterranee. Negotiating the rocky waves, the migrants climb the ladder onto the ship. On board the Ocean Viking, survivors receive clothes and a place to sleep. Some migrants sit on a wooden deck, while others seek the refuge of a container made suitable as living space. There is 40-year-old curtain maker Salim from Syria, who fled his country to keep his son out of the army. They are playing dominoes. His son is called Mahmoud.
I come to here with my father from Syria because I should go to the war after 18 years. So I come with my father to the Libya and from Libya to the Italy and the sea.
Father and son and the other more than 300 rescued migrants passed their time during the rescue mission while enduring encounters with the Libyan Coast Guard that is known for pushing migrants back to Libya. Rescue coordinator Anita says that the Coast Guard does not have jurisdiction.
I think that they are coming and trying to intimidate us to stop heading towards their waters, which we would still in any case never go inside Libyan's water.
The International Organization for Migration attributes the rise of the number of new arrivals to a deteriorating human rights situation in Libya. The migrants from across Africa seek safety in Europe. Ruth Elmendorf for VOA News, Augusta, Italy.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.